correspondence.
Okay, well, first of all, thanks very much to the organisers of this very exciting conference for the invitation to speak here. I'm going to say a little bit about some recent work on the spectrum of the planar n equals 4 theory in the limit of infinite R charge. Most of what I'm going to talk about was contained in two papers that appeared recently, the second of them in collaboration with Heng Yu Chen and Kazuki Okamura, and I'll also at the end have time to say a little bit about some work in progress. So like all the other speakers, or the vast majority of them so far in the conference, I'm interested in verifying, or even beyond that, hopefully even one day demonstrating, that the basic statement of the ADS-CFT correspondence is true. And that statement, of course, is that the spectrum of operator dimensions in the planar limit of n equals 4 super Young Mills should be the same as the spectrum of free strings on ADS-5 cross S5. And as we've heard several times, the problem with verifying this is the problem, the usual weak strong problem, that the two theories on either side of the duality are tractable in very different regimes. If we want to go past the problem, from either end, we either have to tackle the formidable problem, the old problem of summing the planar diagrams in n equals 4 super Young Mills, or on the string side, we have to solve the string sigma model on the world sheet, which is a complicated interacting two-dimensional quantum field theory. So, of course, we've heard a lot about the very promising progress, which hinges on the emergence of integrable structures on both sides of the correspondence. On the gauge theory side, at least at weak coupling, we have a very attractive picture of the anomalous dimensions as being described by an integrable spin chain. And on the string theory classical side, classical integrability, at least a tower of conserved charges, has emerged, which leads to a description of the string as a classical integrable system. Now, there are many correspondences, many things that match between these two descriptions, and in particular, one obvious one is that in both cases, the basic problem is one of finding the spectrum of the system subject to periodic boundary conditions. And under those circumstances, integrability typically leads to a complicated set of equations known as the beta ansatz. As we heard yesterday, that isn't always the case, but hopefully some generalization of the beta ansatz will also apply to things like non-compact sigma models. So in general, this problem of actually interpolating between these two descriptions is still very much unsolved. Largely, well, one key thing is that we don't even know really how to get a beta ansatz by quantizing the string yet, although classical analogs of it, like the KMMZ equations, are obviously very promising. Okay, so recent progress has hinged on the realization that there's actually a very simple limit where the whole problem, and indeed the spectrum itself, simplifies drastically. So in particular, I'm talking about a limit of large R charge or angular momentum on the string side, the same limit that was described in Diego Hoffman's talk and in by several other speakers. And the characteristic feature on both sides of the correspondence is that it allows you to replace the problem with periodic boundary conditions by the problem on an infinite line, where you, instead of thinking about the beta ansatz, you have immediately a picture in terms of local excitations which propagate on the infinite chain or infinite string, and the challenge is to describe the spectrum of these excitations and their scattering. So specifically, I'm thinking about a system with local excitations and vacuum boundary conditions rather than periodic boundary conditions. First of all, this means that in this limit, the spectrum is just a whole lot simpler. It's made up of a certain number of components, although there may be infinite number of such components, the one particle states. And then in this limit, the full spectrum is just the tensor product of all possible one particle states. Secondly, the consequences of integrability are fairly well understood, at least in relativistic models and increasingly in other cases, but typically in this situation, integrability leads directly to a situation where you have completely factorizable scattering of the excitations, and Kostya-Zarembo described that very nicely in the first talk of the conference. So as I said, in this limit, if we can reach this limit, then the challenge is to of solving any theory in this kind of limit with vacuum boundary conditions is to determine the full spectrum and also to determine the S matrix. And one thing I want to emphasize is that those two problems are in no way completely separate and disjoint. There's a very important and fundamental connection between them, which is that the S matrix is an analytic function of parameters and kinematic variables. And as in relativistic cases, its singularities should correspond directly to the contributions of intermediate on-shell states. So in particular, as we'll talk about, singularities of the S matrix like poles correspond to the presence of bound states in the spectrum, just as they do in relativistic field theory. And one can also demonstrate the existence of other interesting singularities like anomalous thresholds. So what I'm going to do in this talk is review the progress determining the spectrum in this limit. There will be some overlaps with a previous talk by Arkady Zeitlin on a similar topic, but hopefully my emphasis will be slightly different, so it won't be identical. and basically the success is that although the full problem seems to be very hard in terms of interpolation, as far as the spectrum is concerned, a very large part of the spectrum is now under control in this limit. The spectrum includes fundamental excitations known as magnons, which have been identified on both sides of the correspondence, as well, and I'll emphasize this, as a rich structure, in fact an infinite set of bound states, many of which are BPS saturated, although there may also be other states which are not BPS saturated. And at least for all the states which are BPS in a sense that I'll describe, the very nice thing is that there's a universal exact dispersion relation, which is a generalization of the dispersion relation that occurs in the BDS beta ansatz and many subsequent authors, but it's now understood to be a consequence of supersymmetry because of the work of Bizet. I'll say less about the S matrix. The previous speaker dealt with that in great detail, but of course the exciting thing is that that is almost determined, although not that process is by no means finished. So to talk about the spectrum, I'm going to follow what seems to be the tradition of most speakers in this conference and start with the simplest sector of the problem, which was historically the one that was first understood, at least in supersymmetric gauge theory. The SU2 sector, which consists of single trace operators formed from two of the three complex adjoint scalar fields of the N equals 4 theory. The fields are labeled by two R charges, J1 and J2, which just counts the number of insertions of each. And of course, the famous result of Minahan and Zarembo is that the problem of finding the anomalous dimensions of these operators at one loop is isomorphic to the problem of diagonalizing the Heisenberg spin chain. More precisely, the operators are in one-to-one correspondence, essentially, with the configurations of the spin chain. The length of the spin chain is just the total number of insertions. And it's very convenient to start thinking about the ferromagnetic vacuum, which we'll define as being filled by X's, and treat the Y's as impurities. So the length of the chain is J1 plus J2, and the number of impurities in terms of R charges is just J2. So the precise statement of the Minahan-Zarembo result is that the planar dilatation operator up to and including one loop is given by a simple classical piece in this sector, just measures the length of the chain, and at one loop, with a coefficient proportional to lambda, what appears is the Hamiltonian of the Heisenberg XX spin chain. And then, of course, we know that there are corrections at higher orders, but let's just stick with the one loop result. Just to define the various symbols I want, let's also think in terms of the eigenvalues of the operators that appear here. Delta, as always, is the scaling dimension. L I've introduced as the length of the chain. And E will be the energy of a corresponding Heisenberg spin chain state. Now I want to examine this system from a very simple-minded perspective, and in particular to illustrate the presence of an interesting spectrum of bound states. And I will, from the beginning, focus on this limit where the spin chain is infinitely long, and I'm thinking about the states with a finite but large number of excitations, like they can be large, but the condition is that we should always have vacuum boundary conditions at infinity, that we should think about things that asymptote to the vacuum at infinity. And we know there are very well tried, well understood then how to go to periodic boundary conditions on a very large circle. Costier's Zarembo also described that. But let's focus for a moment on this problem of the infinite chain. If we have no impurities, we're back in the ferromagnetic ground state, which is now infinitely long. And then, of course, the spectrum simply, in the first case, consists of individual impurities. So we can introduce a single impurity by flipping one of the spins, let's say at the L site, and of course that's not by itself an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, but we can make an eigenstate by giving this flipped spin some momentum so that it propagates along the chain. And I've written down, of course, the well-known corresponding wave function for that on the chain. Evaluating the Hamiltonian on that, you find the dispersion relation of this excitation, which has it's periodic in the momentum because we have still have a discrete system, so it has a Brillouin zone, and has this characteristic sine squared form that probably everyone is very familiar with. So now let's move on from one magnon to two magnons and follow, stick very close to the approach that Beta followed when he originally treated this this problem. If you have two localized excitations in a quantum mechanical system with local interactions, the natural thing is that they will have scattering which is described by an S matrix. So the simplest ansatz you could possibly write down for a two-magnon eigenstate is to write down partial waves where you have an incoming wave and the transmitted wave, or reflected as the particles are identical, there's no difference, the reflected wave differs from the incoming wave by an S matrix. And of course, when you plug this into the problem of finding the spectrum, the S matrix falls out, and it's this characteristic form that involves the differences of rapidities of the individual excitations. So the rapidity in this non-relativistic system, at least at this one loop level that I'm talking about, is the cotangent of the momentum. And the S matrix is an analytic function of this both momenta. And the key factor which is going to be important in what follows is the fact that it has a pole at when the difference in the momenta is equal to, difference in the rapidities is equal to I. So this pole, of course, is a pole that occurs at complex momenta, and we can immediately see what that corresponds to. If I put the transparency on, we can. We can immediately see what that corresponds to by just solving the pole condition and plugging it back into the wave function to see what the wave function looks like. So this pole condition that the difference in rapidities is equal to I, you can solve it simply by demanding that the total sum of the sum of the momenta is a real number, but allowing the momenta to have positive and negative imaginary parts so that their sum is real. If you do that, plug it into the pole condition, you discover there's a solution consistent with P and V being real. It's the only solution that's consistent with that. And then you plug that back into the wave function. And what you find is the wave function of a bona fide state of the system. Because we've now gone to complex momentum, you find that, well, first of all, I've normalized it. The pole in the S matrix kills one of the partial waves and leaves us with a wave function, which is actually the wave function of a normalizable bound state. It's very easy to see here that with this value of V, we're going to have a dependence on the relative positions of the two excitations that decays exponentially as we separate them, whereas the kind of center of mass factor is just that of a free particle. And of course, this is precisely what you expect for the wave function of a bound state in any quantum mechanical system. So what this pole in the S matrix represents is a bound state of two magnons, and as the individual magnons had impurity charge, or J2 charge 1, the bound state has charge 2. So from the point of view of S matrix theory, this is a familiar, familiar idea. The process of forming a bound state that's a true bound state always involves analytically continuing the momenta away from the real line. And always what you discover is that if there is a bound state that that couples to the incoming particles, it can be formed in the S channel at some complex values of the momenta. So we imagine this process as the two magnons coming in, fusing to form a bound state of real momentum, and then separating again. And of course, I emphasize that this process can't occur at real momentum because it's a bound state. It's a real bound state, so you can't, it's below threshold in the language of the kinematics of scattering. But we can, just from knowing where the pole in the S matrix is, work out very easily what the dispersion relation of this new object is. Because all we have to do, as energy is additive, is to add up the energies of the incoming particles. I've already told you that the pole condition solves for the imaginary part V as a function of the real part, and you just plug that in and you find the energy of this composite excitation. And indeed, it's not just less than the energy of the two incoming magnons, it's actually less than the energy of a single magnon with the same momenta. It's half that. So in other words, it's a true bound state because you can check that for any values of momenta Q, any real values of P and Q, E2 of P is always less than or equal to the sum of the momenta of the incoming states. To get equality here, you have to go off the real axis, and that corresponds to a bound state below threshold. So these bound states are absolutely stable. So far, everything that I've said, I've made really no mention of integrability. Everything that I've said so far could be said in any system with local interactions. If you knew the S matrix, you can find such poles. The place where integrability enters in a crucial way was described very clearly by Kostia in his talk. It's when you consider more than one of these excitations, more than one magnon. In that case, the generic consequence of integrability and the existence of an infinite tower of conserved charges on each magnon is that the S matrix, the multiparticle scattering, has to factorize exactly into the product of two-body S matrices. And this fact is, of course, also behind other approaches to deriving the beta ansatz, like the algebraic beta ansatz. So this original connection was made in the case of relativistic 1 plus 1 dimensional field theories by Polyakov, and then followed up by Fadyev and Zamolodchikov. So it means, for example, in this case, if we have an integrable spin chain, an infinite chain, then the three-body S matrix, it will simply be given by the factors, the product of individual two-body factors. And that means that it's easy now to look at the three-body problem and look for corresponding bound states of three magnons incoming. Can we fuse the three magnons? So once again, it corresponds to a singularity, and in this case, it basically corresponds to the sort of maximal singularity that you can get when you allow two of these factors to blow up. And that happens when the first, second, and third excitations are all separated by an amount which is equal to the imaginary unit. And this pattern goes on and on. And in the multiparticle S matrix, you find a tower of bound states that were certainly known about to beta. There's nothing new about this. For each number of constituents, you find a single bound state. And if you plot the positions of the incoming particles in the rapidity plane, those particles form a regular grid known as a beta string, where the separation between each rapidity is exactly equal to I. And you could play the same game of working out the dispersion relation from the position of the singularity. And in this case, you find that the energy has this characteristic form, which actually applies to the single magnon and the two-body bound state, as well as all these other ones. The energy for the Q-magnon bound state is 1/Q of the energy of the original magnon. So this already corresponds to something interesting, I think, in the N equals 4 theory. In this limit we're interested in, we're actually looking at the limit where the operators become infinitely long. And basically, in that limit, it means something to distinguish between states which are normalizable and states which are not. So in particular, in the language of N equals 4, this will correspond to some linear combination of SU2 sector operators where the impurities like to live close together. The coefficients of operators where they don't live close together will be exponentially decaying because those are controlled by the wave function of the state in the spin chain language. So this will correspond to states, eigenvalues of the dilatation operator in the infinite R charge limit, which have this characteristic feature of being normalizable. So Q impurities like to live close together. The way I've written it, they're living exactly on top of each other, but that doesn't have to be the case. There's some admixture of different separations determined by the wave function. So in fact, you get a very nice picture of the full spectrum of the spin chain in this case. So I emphasize that I'm thinking about the limit of infinitely long spin chain. I'm considering boundary conditions where we impose the vacuum at large distances. In other words, operators that asymptote to all x's at large distances. And in that limit, we have a very nice exact description of the complete spectrum of operators which are present. Basically, it's a free multiparticle Fock space made up from the individual components which I've identified. The states which you can make are made up from arbitrary numbers of these local excitations or asymptotic states, each of which can have a momentum, and each of which can have an arbitrary bound state constituent number. So the spectrum of the problem in this limit looks something like that. Now, of course, if you put it on a circle and impose periodic boundary conditions, you'll discretize the spectrum of the momenta, and you'll have to need to impose asymptotic beta conditions to work out the allowed values of the momenta. But in this limit, we can think about continuous momenta. If we want to impose the trace condition, we should just insist that the sum of the momenta of these individual magnons vanishes, and that's it. So in this particular limit, we don't have the beta equations at all. We have a very simple formula for the full spectrum of the model, which is just a sum of arbitrary numbers of free particles, each of them given by this characteristic dispersion relation. So this is quite nice. It's a limit in which the whole spectrum of the problem simplifies dramatically. And this is what's been exploited greatly on both sides of the correspondence in recent work, in particular by Bizet. Well, that wouldn't be something with vacuum boundary conditions as I've described it, because that carries on with alternating spins as you go to infinity. So I'm thinking about the problem with vacuum boundary conditions, and that, of course, is a restriction. But it's also, it's a very, very large infinite set of operators which have this scaling, which you can examine and play this game. And as we haven't been successful so far in finding the correct interpolating beta ansatz between the two sides for the full problem, an obvious question is, how does this picture interpolate between weak coupling and strong coupling? And particular, to generalize that, we have to go beyond the SU2 sector and beyond one loop. So we have to work beyond the confines of the simple Heisenberg spin chain and work in a more general way. And this is really the strategy that's been pioneered in the work of Bizet and also suggestions earlier by Staudacker, that you should think about things in terms of a very long or infinite chain, and we should think about things in terms of local excitations around a ground state. So the nice thing is that you can apply this approach without knowing what the all-loop Hamiltonian is. You can already find very, very strong constraints from symmetries. And this is basically the avenue that's been explored in the last year by, in a series of papers, starting with a paper of Bizet. If we consider now the ground state, the infinite ground state, the first thing to think about is, what is the symmetry of the problem? Well, of course, the ground state breaks some of the superconformal invariants of the n equals 4 theory. So that's sort of spontaneously broken in the language of particle physics, if you like. But there's still a large unbroken supersymmetry left over that consists of a product of two SU2/2 supergroups. And as you'd expect, as that supersymmetry is unbroken by the ground state, it's linearly realized on the individual impurities that appear. So in fact, what you can show is that I can take the ground state and think about the basic impurities that I can insert, give them some momentum, and in general, those will form some representation of the supergroup. In other words, the local excitations will form multiplets of this unbroken supersymmetry. And the key observation is that the supersymmetry is realized in a very interesting way when you allow non-zero momentum. The supersymmetry with non-zero algebra in the presence of non-zero momentum acquires a non-trivial central charge, which is absolutely crucial to the considerations that follow. So in fact, this is a version of a story that's very familiar to those people who study supersymmetry and superstrings. It's the story of the power of BPS conditions and the power of having things that live in special short representations, which are protected by BPS formulae. So in particular, what happens in this case is that the impurities together form a short multiplet of this centrally extended SU2/2 squared. So in the language of representations of supergroups, it's the sort of bifundamental representation of the supergroup, but fundamental in each of the two factors, and it contains a total of 16 states. And the dispersion relation for each element of this multiplet is the standard one that we've seen many times in this conference now. But the key thing, although this dispersion relation had been guessed, realized from many other points of view, other directions, is that in this context, it's an exact statement which follows from the supersymmetry algebra, like many other similar statements in supersymmetric string theory and field theory. So we have an exact dispersion relation for these local excitations, and that's already a very powerful constraint on the spectrum. The constraints from supersymmetry, almost supersymmetry alone, remarkably go much further, and as we heard about this morning, they actually constrain the S matrix up to a single overall phase, which still remains to be determined. So that's very remarkable, because the S matrix for scattering of these two multiplets, having 16 states coming in on either side, is a 256 by 256 matrix. So it's very appealing, the fact that it's now determined up to a single unknown function of the momenta and the coupling constant. I mean exact in the context of this infinite spin chain with vacuum boundary conditions. But that's the parameters that I'm setting for myself here. But of course, knowing the exact S matrix and the exact dispersion relations in this limit would then allow you to go to a large chain by the asymptotic beta ansatz. I mean, that's your idea, right? Might be what, sorry?
I mean, we don't know. Mm-hmm. But this thing might, I mean, this quadratic map of the interplay role for a finite chain, so it's not here. It could be just exact theory, but it's an open issue.
But it seems to be a very promising approach to assume that this is the right picture in this limit, and just look at the constraints that you can get from the symmetries and integrability. So in particular, if you do make these assumptions, then it leads, on symmetry arguments alone, by this papers by Beiser, to an exact form for the S matrix. So if we have the exact S matrix, we can already say quite a lot about the exact spectrum. So an obvious question is, what does the singularity structure of the exact S matrix look like? That involves, it's not completely nailed down because of the unknown dressing factor, but one can make a very plausible case that the pole which is present at zero coupling or weak coupling in the Heisenberg spin chain persist to all orders. And the basic reason is that in the SU2 sector, the S matrix up to this overall dressing factor is the one conjectured by BDS, Beisert, Dippel, and Staudacker, and it has this characteristic form, which is the same form involving the difference of the rapidities. It still has a pole at the same position, but the kinematics of where the pole lies is now much more complicated, because the formula for the rapidity receives similar corrections to the dispersion relation and involves one of these square roots. So perhaps it's not totally inconceivable that this pole could be cancelled by a zero in the prefactor, but the fact that we can identify the corresponding bound states in different limits, I think, effectively rules that possibility out. So let's proceed for the moment with the idea that we should follow the consequences of this pole from weak coupling to strong coupling and see where it leads. So one can repeat exactly the same calculation that I described on my previous transparencies, the simple Beta-like calculation for the position of the pole, using it to derive the dispersion relation. One can repeat exactly the same calculation for the BDSS matrix. The pole just cares about this term, and once you solve for the pole condition and plug it back into the energy, well, it's a lot more complicated than in the Heisenberg case, but the answer is very simple. It turns out to be a dispersion relation, which looks very much like the original one, but with four here instead of one. So what does that mean? Well, we expect it to mean a two-magnon bound state, first of all, because this is a continuation of what we found in the Heisenberg spin chain. And more remarkably, we expect that because this is the exact S matrix, and this pole is a feature of the exact S matrix, modulo the caveat that I produced, I reviewed briefly, that this is the exact dispersion relation for this excitation. So how can we explain that? Well, the obvious explanation is that it has something to do with BPS conditions, and in fact, that seems to be the correct explanation. So first of all, I should say that one goes on to consider the same calculation that I described in the context of the Heisenberg spin chain, looking for the poles, interpreting the same poles of the BDSS matrix, but now with the full form of the rapidity. And one finds exactly the same pattern, that there is an infinite tower of these bound states with labeled by an integer q that takes all integer values from 1 to infinity. And the exact dispersion relation is determined by the exact S matrix to be this one. So while the obvious conjecture is that these states are BPS2, and it's not too hard to convince yourself that that's actually what's going on. You can run through a very similar argument to the one that Beisert used, realizing the algebra on not on the fundamental representation, but now on a larger representation, which I'll describe in a moment. And you discover that at least in this particular sector, what's happening in the supersymmetry algebra is that as well as on the right-hand side getting Bizet's central charge, you also have a contribution from the R charge. And that contribution is actually responsible for the one in the original dispersion relation. And the algebra actually allows for short multiplets with higher values of the R charge, which live in short multiplets, which have this BPS protected dispersion relation. Noting that Q-Magnon bound states in the SU2 sector have this charge, Q is equal to J2, we find that this is the explanation. That in fact you can actually have BPS saturated states in larger representations, still short but larger, more states, representations of the supersymmetry. So it looks like there's an infinite tower of BPS states in the theory, in this limit. One could quantify that a little bit more precisely, and this is in a paper which will be appearing soon, by trying to run through Bizet's arguments more precisely and working out what representation of the supergroup these bound states live in. And our preliminary result is that it's in a kind of traceless symmetric tensor representation in both factors that's represented by Young tableau with these strange cross boxes, which is a notation invented by Itzhak Dars for the representation theory of supergroups. So we think we know what these representations are, and they're very large. They grow at the very least, they grow with the power q to the 4, if not more. They contain things like traceless symmetric tensor representations of the SO4R symmetry group. And in many ways, the particle content is actually very similar to the classification of spherical harmonics on S5 that you find when you classify the chiral primaries. So that seems to be an interesting connection. But the S matrix alone is already powerful enough to tell you that if you believe it, and you believe in the poles, and you interpret them directly, the states that correspond to them must form representations of supersymmetry, and it's not too hard to work out what the representations are, and we claim this is the answer, that you have, for each Q, you have a large multiplet with a protected dispersion relation, which corresponds to this particular symmetrized, traceless symmetrized representation of the supergroup. Sure. That's absolutely true in this case also. So I should own up to that immediately. I've made the conventional assumption that the mystery function of lambda is just lambda over pi squared, because that's what you see at weak and strong coupling. Now, of course, so the justification for that is exactly the same, on the same footing as it is in the basic case. I don't think so, because then the dispersion relations wouldn't match. It has to be the same function, because the dispersion relation is determined in terms of the dispersion relations of the constituents. So I think it has to be the same function, and if you assume it's lambda for the bottom of the tower, then it's lambda all the way up. But the nice difference between these states, we have now some new limits that one can take, because we heard yesterday about the strong coupling limits of the fundamental magnon, and if you have one here and you take lambda to infinity, you lose part of the information. You just pick up the second term, if you have Q being equal to 1. And so you find this state called the giant magnon on the other side, which has basically something proportional to sine P over 2. The nice thing is that once you have this extra degree of freedom, you can examine the spectrum on the string theory side in more detail. Because if you have bound states formed from any number of constituents, you can choose that number of constituents to scale with square root lambda as you take square root lambda to be large. In other words, you can engineer it so that the whole of this square root dispersion relation scales like the square root of lambda. And therefore, the whole of this square root dispersion relation should be visible in semi-classical string theory. Because this, if we believe the BPS property, these states are absolute fixtures of the spectrum for all values of lambda. Their full dispersion relation survives as a formula, at least if I scale Q like this. So we should be able to see them directly by doing a semi-classical string calculation. So that's what I'm now going to describe. How much time do I have, by the way? Oh, okay. I can slow down. Well, that's the idea somehow. The idea is the idea of the asymptotic beta ansatz is somehow that the length goes to infinity faster than the range of the interaction increases. So it's exactly the same kind of assumption. So it should be the same story as that, right? That in this particular limit, it suffices to think about these local excitations. So the nice thing is, as I said, you can make a lot more progress this way, and hopefully this will one day, or this will already hopefully, start to feed back into the beta ansatz, and then the next question will be about how finite J corrections work. But still, there is still work to be done in determining the full spectrum, even in this limit, I should say, so it's not all completely sorted out, I should say that. But let's now go over to the string theory side of the story. And here I'll be slightly more less inclusive, I'll be more brief, because Diego Hoffman's talk really covered this in some detail yesterday. Hoffman and Maldacena succeeded in identifying a corresponding limit that corresponds to this infinite string limit, infinite spin chain limit, a corresponding limit on the string side. Basically, it's the same limit. It involves taking one of the R charge, which is now an angular momentum of the string on S5, to be very large, while keeping the Toft coupling fixed. And of course, to use semi-classical methods in string theory, we better keep the Toft coupling fixed and very large, so that we can believe a semi-classical analysis, at least for some states. And as we heard yesterday, a very appealing picture in terms of the same ingredients emerges naturally on the string side of the correspondence. Once again, you're dealing with a system with vacuum boundary conditions rather than one with periodic boundary conditions. The spectrum can be analyzed in terms of local excitations. The great discovery of Hoffman and Maldacena is that the same states that correspond to the fundamental magnon on the gauge theory side crop up as classical solitons on the string theory side. So you think about these as some objects which move along the string without changing their shape, a reflection of the infinite number of conserved charges they carry. And in the simplest case, they were able to map the dynamics of these solitonic objects onto a known completely integrable nonlinear PDE, simply the Sine-Gordon equation. So then it automatically follows that the classical analog of factorized scattering occurs automatically on the string side. The Sine-Gordon equation describes the scattering of solitons, of localized lumps. They scatter with each other in arbitrary numbers, and the scattering can completely be understood in terms of the time delays in pairwise collisions. If you have three colliding, you just have to add up the time delays in the collisions from each of the pairwise collisions. So you find exactly the same structure, or at least a classical analog of factorized scattering here, immediately with the correspondence to the Sine-Gordon equation. So more precisely, what Maldacena and Hoffman did was consider this limit for the one-charge states, states which carry just one angular momentum, which is becoming large. And in that case, they used, if it only carries one charge, you can have the string moving just on a two-sphere subspace of ADS of S5. There's also a time coordinate, which you need to include. But basically, one is dealing with the bosonic two-sphere sigma model with Virasoro constraints. And there's a very old reduction procedure due to Pollmeyer that maps the solutions of the sigma model equations with Virasoro constraints onto the solutions of the Sine-Gordon equation. And that's why this structure, you can see that the structure of integrability is immediately inherited, and you find factorized scattering on both sides of the correspondence. So Pollmeyer's reduction procedure also works on larger subsectors. In particular, if you start with an n-sphere, you get by this reduction. The reduction procedure basically is just looking at the dynamics of the quantities which are invariant under the isometry group of the target space. So there's a single quantity whose dynamics characterizes the string solution, which is invariant under the SU2 isometry of S2. But there are analogs of this for the higher spheres. So in general, this leads to what's called generalized Sine-Gordon equation. But in the case that I want to look at, where one thinks about just string states which carry two conserved R charges, like the states in the gauge theory I'm thinking about, it suffices to look at the sigma model with Virasoro constraints with target space a three-sphere. So this is the usual kind of SU2 sector of the classical string theory. But in this particular limit, You can use the Pollmeyer reduction procedure to reduce the classical dynamics to the dynamics of what's called the complex Sine-Gordon equation. So, as there's a room full of people who are experts in integrable systems, I'm sure complex Sine-Gordon theory will be more familiar to people than it would be if I'd given this seminar elsewhere, but in case it's not, let me just briefly say what it is. It's an integrable partial differential equation. Rather than for a single real scalar field, it's convenient to combine the 2 degrees of freedom into a single complex field, which depends on the world sheet coordinates sigma and tau, which now lie on an infinite line times the time direction. So it's a nonlinear equation for this complex field, which generalizes somehow the linear equation, the nonlinear equation for the S2 sector, which was just the ordinary Sine-Gordon equation. And indeed, there's a mapping between this field and the Sine-Gordon field that if you throw away 1 degree of freedom, it reduces back to the ordinary Sine-Gordon equation. But this is a completely integrable partial differential equation that's been studied for a long time, going back to work by people like Getmanov and Lund and Reggie. And there's a well-known spectrum of solitons. So the solitons basically are localized bumps of this field psi. They look like bumps in the modulus of psi. They propagate with a conserved shape, and they propagate with some constant velocity, which I'll parameterize in terms of the rapidity theta. And the soliton solution involves some, the modulus of the field is some constantly translating lump, but the difference between this and ordinary Sine-Gordon theory is that there's an extra degree of freedom. The lump also spins in the internal U1 space, and the spinning is described by this phase factor. And an additional parameter of the solution enters here in the phase factor, which I'll call the parameter alpha. So sine of alpha appears up here. So it's a solution which involves a translating lump, which is also spinning in an internal U1. And this is precisely what we'll want to reproduce the behavior in gauge theory that I was describing earlier. So we have solitons with 2 parameters instead of the ordinary Sine-Gordon kink, which has only 1. Like the Sine-Gordon case, the soliton has a conserved rapidity. But in addition, now we have an additional rotation parameter, which I called alpha. So just like Maldacena and Hoffman did, it's a non-trivial but fairly straightforward to take a solution of this reduced equation and reconstruct the full solution for the string theory. Basically, once you've found a solution of this, it reduces the problem of finding the string motion to the problem of solving some linear differential equations, which in general is usually a tractable problem. And indeed, it turns out to be the case here. I wish I'd actually produced a few more transparencies on this so I could have shown you some more details. But basically, once you know about this complex Sine-Gordon soliton, it allows you to reconstruct the corresponding string motion. And it's really a pretty straightforward generalization of the giant magnon that Maldacena and Hoffman talked about yesterday. So its appearance is very similar. If you just look at an S2 subspace of S3, it looks like one of these arcs of string with endpoints moving at the speed of light on the equator of the S2. The really substantive difference is that it also spins in an orthogonal direction, an orthogonal plane in S3. So it carries a second conserved angular momentum. And that, in fact, is precisely the properties of the solution that we want, because if you think about these bound states, they carry a conserved finite angular momentum, which I call J2, which counts how many impurities are stuck together, as well as, of course, having a total R charge. The length of the operator is becoming infinite as before. So it's not too hard. I should say that these solutions have also been discussed by several other groups. They were found by very different methods by several other authors. But once you have the solution, it's then straightforward to translate back into the language of string theory and find the dependence of the string theoretic momentum, energy, and charges on the parameters of the Sine-Gordon soliton. So the dictionary looks something like this. And the nice thing is that when you square these terms and combine them in the appropriate way, out pops the square root dispersion relation that we were looking for. And the fact that this generalizes to multi-soliton solutions really just follows immediately from the complete integrability of the complex Sine-Gordon solution. There are complex Sine-Gordon equation. There are you can construct multi-soliton solutions which undergo factorized scattering, and their masses on the string side will just be given by the sum of contributions of this form, because they consist, after a long time, of far-separated localized lumps. So basically what this means is that you can reproduce the entire dispersion relation of the magnon bound state from the string theory side. Now, of course, this is classical string theory, so the charges J1 and J2 are continuous parameters. J1 is infinite, whereas J2 is finite and is a variable parameter. Of course, when we go to semi-classical quantization, we expect that angular momentum will be quantized in integer units. So you will find a tower of these objects with integer-valued spacings. And indeed, a naive semi-classical quantization, at least for large values of J2, appears to give precisely this discrete quantization, which gives you precise correspondence to the spectrum of the magnon bound states. So perhaps at the end, I have just long enough to mention some work in progress, which is, of course, to further probe the issue of the S matrix and its agreement between strong and weak coupling. What one can try and do is to now do a comparison of the S matrix for the scattering of these bound states, both on the gauge theory side and on the string theory side. So on the string theory side, the calculation is a generalization of the calculation that Diego described yesterday. You take the scattering solution of the complex sine-Gordon equation for two of these lumps, and you calculate the time delay in the scattering. How long the solitons are held up by their interaction. How much the interaction is, the trajectory is retarded in time relative to free propagation. And there's actually a well-known expression for the time delay, at least in the center of mass frame, in terms of the parameters of the individual solitons. By semi-classical methods, you can pass directly from this to the semi-classical approximation to the S matrix on the world sheet, using the same formula that Diego described yesterday, which is originally due to Jakeev and Wu. The semi-classical formula tells you that, at least at leading order in square root lambda, the derivative of the phase of the S matrix with respect to the energy of the objects that are being scattering should be equal to the classical time delay. So this produces, after integrating this up, a prediction for the S matrix for the scattering of these bound states. So now, what one would like to do is to do an analog of the comparison that Diego described yesterday for the scattering of the objects in gauge theory, from the gauge theory side. So now we're talking about not just the scattering of two single magnons, but the scattering of two of these strings of beta roots. And to really make contact with the semi-classical side, we're actually going to want to take these Q1 and Q2s to be suitably large numbers. In fact, well, you could take them to be anything, but the calculation simplifies considerably when Q1 and Q2 are large. So now, because of integrability, it's actually not too hard to calculate the scattering of the bound states. Because of integrability, it's essentially just the scattering of each of the individual magnons which make up the two bound states with each other. In other words, you can compute the S matrix just by taking the elementary magnon S matrix and multiplying factors together that correspond to the scattering of each constituent with each other constituent. So you get a large product here, which thankfully simplifies. So to do this, to find agreement, of course, you expect that you won't get exact agreement with the gauge theory BDS ansatz, but you'll actually have to use a specific dressing factor. And the obvious comparison to make is with the magnon S matrix with both the AFS and BDS components in place. So basically what one can do is to take this S matrix, multiply its many factors together over the chains of beta roots, basically take a limit of large quantum numbers so that the various products after exponentiation turn into integrals, and compare it with the results on that I described on the classical string theory side. And in a forthcoming paper, the preliminary result, which we think is now solid, is that the two things actually do agree. And in fact, The consistency of this procedure actually provides some constraints on the AFS factor. They're actually constraints we already knew about. It turns out that this kind of procedure, it looks like that you can obtain a kind of a new way of deriving why the sigma AFS has to be this characteristic form of the exponential of the sum of bilocal terms. So perhaps I'll say something about that at the end if people want to ask. So this is the natural generalization of the Hoffman-Maldacena comparison, and it seems to work. So in some way that doesn't actually answer any of the questions about the S matrix, but it's hoped that further investigation on both sides of the spectrum and the spectrum and the corresponding structure of the S matrix might be revealing. So I'll finish with just describing there are many, many open questions, but in particular, I've talked about a subset of the states, and those are essentially all the states that are visible in this limit on the gauge theory side of the correspondence. These towers of BPS bound states, over which we have exact control. There can be other states. Perhaps there are states at strong coupling, and in particular, the candidates which appear to be there in the classical limit in string theory are the ones that Diego described. They correspond to Sine-Gordon breathers, and there are corresponding breathers of the complex Sine-Gordon equation. So the problem remains, what are these states? Why don't we see them at weak coupling in the spin chain? And if anyone has any answers to that, I'd like to know. It's interesting to think in general about how far one could go with the game of trying to constrain the S matrix from the singularity structure which is implied by the presence of these states. So I have to report that, I mean, the first thing is that the BPS states don't tell you very much that it's new for the following reason. Their dispersion relations are essentially determined by the matrix part of the S matrix, in other words, not by the overall phase. Everything is done with the exact results of Bizet, and nothing depends on the overall phase. And in fact, that sort of agrees with the fact that the BPS spectrum and the S matrix are both fixed by symmetry at this level. So the question is about the interesting non-BPS states and whether they lead to poles in the overall phase and whether this will lead to further constraints on the S matrix. And that's an avenue that I hope people will investigate. There is also interesting questions about whether what happens when you consider in more generality the S matrices for all these bound states and whether you can apply some kind of bootstrap methodology to derive further constraints and whether that actually might give you an alternative way of perhaps deriving Bizet's SU2/2 squared S matrix. So that's currently under investigation, but I don't have anything to report yet. Okay, I'll stop there.
Questions?
So in this complex Sine-Gordon, you should be able to construct two types of SU2 breathers. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right.
And so I was wondering if you were thinking about scattering these two different types against each other. And if
absolutely. And this calculation will... So I should rewind a couple of transparencies. So I think this is revealing because in the SU2 sector of the spin chain, J2 is positive. You make bound states from Ys, scalar fields Y, not Y bar. On the string theory side, at least naively, for large J2, you have both negative and positive values. And that somehow corresponds to the fact that this S3 sector is also, it consists of somehow the combination of an SU2 sector and an SU2 bar sector, referring to Y bar excitations. This might throw some light on further light on crossing symmetry, as you might expect that the Y bars are in some sense the antiparticles of the Ys. But I'm not sure about that. So this J2 can be negative or positive. So those will correspond to Y bound states or Y bar bound states. And a further puzzle is that, very naively, J2 can also be zero, and you want to eliminate that state, and someone has to work out how that state is eliminated. That's right. Well, so the one thing we're currently working on is that's exactly what happens in, if you take the quantum complex Sine-Gordon theory or the quantum Sine-Gordon theory, which is not directly relevant, of course, here, you find these poles in the exact S matrix, and the poles condense to give the semi-classical answer. So it's a very natural strategy to try and reproduce the classical result by a product of poles corresponding to these bound states. And that's something I'm looking at the moment.
Okay, maybe one more question.
There's two up there. Well, okay. So one idea which we've just looked at very recently is, I mean, the AFS factor has a very nice feature, right? It's written, and in fact, the whole family of such dressing factors have this, they are functions of the conserved charges, right? They're written as functions of the conserved charges, okay? So they take... The bound states have definite values of all those conserved charges. So there is an AFS factor for each bound state that you get automatically just by plugging those values of the conserved charges into your formula, into the general formula. And there is also an AFS factor that you would get by multiplying the products together from the scattering of the individual components. Now, those two things are only the same if the dressing factor has the characteristic form of E to the sum of something that's bilinear in the charges. So we believe that this approach provides another derivation. Actually, I don't quite know what the first derivation of that was, but it's supposed to be a consequence of integrability, and it appears here somehow as a consequence of integrability and consistency of the S matrix here. So we believe that the BPS bound states provide a new derivation of the generic form of the dressing factor. However, unfortunately, they don't seem to constrain the coefficients at the moment. So that will require information about the non-BPS sectors.
Okay, we should thank you.